Will the Senate Education Committee come to order? We have with us Senator Dunleavy, Senate President Huggins, and myself, Stevens. Probably have a couple others show up here later, but let's move ahead with the two issues we're dealing with today. Senate Bill 57 on literacy, people, transportation, teacher notices, and Senate Bill 47, the stipend for statewide boarding schools. If you are confused, we've switched those two so that we're dealing with 57 first, so that the House can deal with 47, or the equal to it on the House side, and then the folks can come over here to assist us on understanding the stipend for boarding schools. So let's begin with Senate Bill 57. Tim Lampkin is here and ready to introduce the bill. Mr. Lampkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Before us this morning is, first of all, Senate Bill 57. On its face, I'll explain it to you by section. It does three things. First of all, it's an effort to encourage parental involvement in children's ability to proficiently read by the third grade. There's a growing body of evidence that indicates that it's critical that our students have a basic level proficiency by that age and by that grade level. And this is an effort of, by the state to introduce a more aggressive publicity campaign to educate the public and parents in particular with children that are in K through third grade of the importance of reading. So on its face, that's what that's first section does, is that very thing, is to encourage more parental involvement. Section 2 adjusts the pupil transportation dollars annually by the inflationary index of Anchorage. Last year, you may recall that we did pass the same bill from this very committee and through finance, but sort of at the 11th hour, that CPI adjustment was reduced to 1.5%. That's what's on the books currently, and so this bill would strike that and replace it with the annual adjustment of the CPI, which is in the neighborhood of 3% annually. Section 3 would shift the deadline for districts to notify faculty of layoff or non-retention from March 16th to May 15th. Arguably, that has been an arbitrary date that's been set up for many, many years. In fact, my research indicates it may have gone back as far as the 60s. And our budget cycle is incompatible with that. It's accordingly unfair for us to not pass a budget until roughly, say, March 10th or so, when they have a deadline of March 16th where they have to notify teachers and so forth and non-retention. And then we pass the budget, and then they have to retract all of those pink slip notices. So this would align our budget cycle and their deadlines to that respective date. Section 4, of course, would repeal the 1.5% pupil transportation as enacted last year. Section 5 is a required language to allow existing employment contracts with school districts and faculty to expire before we would use the May 15th deadline. And then finally, Section 6 would give it a overall effective date of July 1st of this year. That completes my testimony as far as the general effect of this legislation. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to public testimony at your pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Lampkin, and I recognize Senator Gardner. Thank you for being here. So three very interesting issues that I know have folks from different sides and anxious to hear the testimony and hear what folks have to say. Who do you have set up to testify first? Anybody in particular?
The superintendents, for example.
Okay. So we'll just open this to public testimony, and anybody care to speak to it? Maybe the department would have some comments on it. Any concerns from the department? Questions about it from the Department of Education? Mr. Moore?
Very quickly, I did want to just explain one thing about the fiscal note.
Sure.
On the transportation component. The fiscal note looks a little different than many of our fiscal notes, and when it goes to finance, we can talk to the co-chairs there and see how they'd want that presented. In the past finance, along with the administration, asked us to present fiscal notes for the public education fund, addressing the cumulative effect. So the way that fiscal note works, if you look out to FY19, that's all the money this bill would cost cumulatively across all years. That's different than how most fiscal notes are put together, which just shows the increment per year. It's just was the practice that we were asked to follow last year. It's the practice that the department continued because of that request, but it presents a little bit of a different picture. And so when it goes to finance, I think we will ask them how they would like that presented and maybe readdress that. But I thought it was important you know that, because you look at it compared to other fiscal notes, it looks like it's a much more expensive bill than it really is. It really goes up by a little less than $2 million the first couple of years, and then around $2 million the out years, which is less than the way it would appear. The only other piece is on the literacy, I think. Well,
before we go on, I thank you for that. I'm comfortable with that. If everyone else is, we'll, as it goes on to finance, we'll straighten out those details on the fiscal note. Yeah, please go ahead.
And the other piece was around the literacy. I think we've had some conversation about the where the burden will be in terms of distribution of materials, and Dr. McCauley will just address that real quickly.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Susan McCauley. I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the department. The fiscal note with regard to the literacy component of this bill assumed that the department would be providing the mentioned resources directly to K through 3, the parents of K through 3 students in Alaska, approximately 45,000 students. And so the cost, again, reflect that we would develop and then directly distribute to parents the publication materials. So if that were not the case, if that were not the intent, then the fiscal note might look different.
Thank you, Mr. Crowley. Well, Mr. Crowley, I did meet with the Commissioner of Education yesterday and explained that it wasn't my intention that the department necessarily have a staff and do all of the work, but in fact they work with the districts. Some districts apparently are already doing this, and that's really wonderful to hear that, but not all districts are. And particularly some rural districts where I think we need to really make those materials available to parents to help their young children come up to speed on reading. So the intention was not to have the department hire a full-time staff and do the oversight. And is there any discussion on that issue? Is everyone comfortable with that? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Would it make sense, and I don't know how this would work, but to have small school districts, rather than inventing this stuff themselves, just get it from other districts?
Yes, exactly. And actually, the plan was that the department would prepare to have it available and provide the provide some money on TSAs, as well as doing providing written material. And so it would the department would be responsible for giving the material, but not necessarily for keeping a list and mailing it out and getting to every parent. The district should be able to do that much better than the department could. Would that be your understanding, Mr. Morris?
Correct. The intent is we really could remove that staff member. We wouldn't need that, but we'd still use some services money to prepare the publications or the materials. And then it probably makes sense that we could print and even distribute them, because many of the rural districts distribute them to the district, and then the district could take it from there. So many of the rural districts might, it may be more expensive if we have 53 districts printing a publication versus if we provide them a publication. But it would completely remove the staff. The services line item may be able to be adjusted as well if we look at that in terms of no staff member being necessary. And I think in the first year we put a little more in services to prepare things, but then we would reduce it, thinking that you'd just be updating things versus having to create something in an original form.
Thank you, Senator. A very good question, and frankly, it's my mistake. We put it in writing. We put it in so that it was the department's responsibility, but really intended that they work with the districts to provide that material. Thank you very much. We'll go on to David Means. Mr. Means from Juneau, good to have you with us, sir.
Good morning, Senators. I'm David Means. I'm the Director of Administrative Services with the Juneau School District. The Juneau School District supports Senate Bill 57. I'll draw your attention to Section 2, which discusses our cost of living increase for pupil transportation contracts. Our contract with the Juneau First Student contains a cost of living increase in that contract. This bill would keep the state payments in pace with our payments to our contractor for our services. That means that our foundation's monies would be put into the classroom as much as possible and would not have to be put into providing pupil transportation services to the district. I'd like to point out that in the current law, there's a 1.5% increase for FY14 and FY15. There's not an increase in that law for FY16 and thereafter. This would be a situation where in FY16 and thereafter, payments would keep pace with our costs. I also support Section 3 here. This would provide more flexibility to all districts regarding its tenured teachers. In times of tight budgets, we may have to eliminate or reduce particular programs. It may affect tenured teachers in our case. And under Section 1, of course, we support all partnerships between this, our district and our parents. Our parents are a very vital, important piece of a child's education, especially in grades kindergarten through third grade. And communications, information to parents is vital to those parents and in their role in this partnership. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Means. I found as a school board president that it very difficult to deal with the non-retention date. It was after, you know, we had to make a decision on pink slips before we knew what the legislature was going to fund. But I understand there is some controversy about that. Can you tell us sort of both sides of the issue? Are there some concerns you have? Are there concerns you've heard about changing this date that we should at least be aware of?
From my perspective, it's only in a situation where you're really in a tight situation of somebody whose educational background, qualifications, endorsement is not needed in the future years because of the positions being eliminated. This would give us a chance to reduce that position. It is my understanding that probably there's less controversy on changing the dates than one would have expected, mm-hmm. from what I've heard on the grapevine.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Means. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. What is the normal time when teachers sign contracts or renew contracts for the coming year?
In our practice, we issue the contracts to teachers actually in the May, towards the end of the school year. This is our practice in the June district. I don't know what the practice is in other districts on that, but we do issue the contracts after our budget process is complete. We know the exact assignment of what every teacher is. In our collective bargaining agreement, we have to specify not only, yes, you're coming back, but what your assignment is, what class that you will be teaching. And so we go through our budget process. We finish our budget process shortly after the legislature adjourns because, you know, in case there's any change in foundation monies, any other, monies there, we'll finish our budget process towards the last part of April. We'll be able to issue teachers contracts with notices, you know, which school and what assignment within that school.
Yes, please, Senator Gardner.
So it's unlikely that you'd be offering a contract in early May and then turn around 2 weeks later and pink slip somebody who's...
Well, that's us. We do not want to do that, no. Mm-hmm. I think that once we've offered a contract, it's irrevocable on a tenured teacher. I'd have to refer to the HR department on a non-tenured teacher.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate your being with us. We'll go on to Amy Lujan from the from Juneau. Did I pronounce that right? Our close Lujan. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Amy. Amy Lujan.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Amy Lujan, and I'm with the Alaska Association of School Business Officials. And several of our members were in your offices a few weeks ago expressing support for this bill, among others. And so our members are the people like David Means who are the school business people in all the districts. So our members deal directly with these pupil transportation contracts, for example. And last year, we were able to assist with the drafting of the Senate Bill 182, I think it was, that revamped the pupil transportation funding mechanism, so we were glad to be able to do that. However, as you've already recognized at the very end, they did change this escalator on the reimbursements for pupil transportation, and I believe that sort of went against the intent of the bill, which was to make sure that classroom resources would not be used for pupil trans. And so this is sort of correction, if you will. I recognize there's a fiscal note attached, but the intent of the bill last year was clearly to make sure that the districts did not have to use classroom resources for pupil transportation. The way it is now, with the 1.5% instead of the CPI, most of the contracts around the state reference that CPI, and so there will be over time, in all likelihood, a gap in what districts are reimbursed and what they're expected to pay. The reference to the anchor CPI, my understanding was that that was put in there as sort of a best practice standardization of contracts several years ago when the Department of Ed was assisting districts with those contracts, and it was recommended that the CPI for Anchorage be used. So that's how we got there, and we definitely support this bill to change back to the use of the Anchorage CPI, which will be in sync with the contracts that are out there. Also definitely supportive of Section 3. I have worked in three school districts myself, and I can tell you that it does create some angst when we're still waiting to find out the funding, both from the local cities and boroughs as well as the legislature, and those contracts have to be done so early. Sometimes it's good to get an indication from teachers early, but to be tied to that very early date can be difficult for the districts to do proper planning, especially in the days where now we have all the highly qualified requirements and you have to make sure that everybody's, you know, slotted correctly, and it's a difficult planning situation. So to have more flexibility on that date would certainly be helpful.
Thank you, Ms. Lohan.
Thank
Senator
you.
Gardner.
Thank you. Your reference, those contracts have to be done so early. Do you mean the pink slips or actual contracts?
Well, both. I mean, if we're doing contracts, if we have to put them out by, you know, a certain date, payoff or non-retention or contracts, you know, one or the other by the March 16th date. Mm-hmm.
Does this legislation change the contract date or just the non-retention?
Well, I think the way most districts handle it is they'll give a contract or they'll give a non-retention. You know, they'll kind of
at
use
the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a change then for the contract dates.
I believe so. Now, there could be some variability in the way the negotiated agreements address that that I may not be fully aware of, but I think that's the way most districts handle it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the questions. Thank you, Ms. Lohan. I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have Mike Abbott with the Anchorage School District. Is Mr. Abbott online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hello, Mr. Abbott. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Abbott. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Anchorage School District, and I'm here today on behalf of our school board to testify in support of Senate Bill 57. The school district here in Anchorage strongly supports all three provisions of the bill. We're strongly in support of the promotion of literacy as described in Section 1. We also strongly support the CPI adjustment for pupil transportation and the recalibration of the pink slip date for teachers in Section 3 as well. Be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, or I can also get out of the way and let you get to other presenters.
No, thank you, Mr. Abbott. Appreciate your being here with us. So on the first issue, then, of assisting parents, we realize that some districts are into this, have been doing it for some time. Others have not considered it and need some help. Where is the Anchorage School District in this issue?
I think we're probably a little closer towards the end of the spectrum that's already made progress and continues to make progress in this area. We have a number of pre-K and early childhood partnerships and internal programs that are designed to provide parents and child care providers with the resources necessary to help kids be ready to read when they get to kindergarten.
Well, thank you, Mr. Abbott. That was my understanding, too, that Anchorage is sort of ahead of the game in many other districts that need to be assisted and brought to speed. Any further questions of Mr. Abbott? Senator Gardner.
Yeah, I'd just like to know when Anchorage currently offers teacher contracts. What time of year?
It's I just heard the gentleman from Juneau describe their process. We're on a similar process here in Anchorage.
And And can you just tell me when they're offered?
Well, it depends. There's not a hard date by which they're offered. It'll depend on the hiring situation and the rest of that, but we strive to do so before the end of the school year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. Thank you very much, Mr. Abbott. I appreciate your being with us. We'll move on to Dave Jones from Soldotna, the assistant superintendent. Can you hear us, Mr. Jones?
Yes, I can.
Thanks for being with us, Dave. Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record, if you would.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Jones. I'm the assistant superintendent for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. Here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill number 57. Again, I agree with the previous speakers. I think all three of these sections are worthy of moving forward, and we're in support of those. Early literacy is something that the more we can get the word out to people and give them assistance in bringing their students into our schools with those capabilities already in place, the easier it's going to be for us to move them down the road towards graduation. On the Section 2 with student transportation, last year when the legislature passed Senate Bill 182, that was a great bill for the Kenai because we were in a large deficit situation with the way the funding had been, and it brought us to full funding. We support the change to the inclusion of the Anchorage CPI because if it doesn't occur, then we will start to see the little chipping away of a you know, a dollar amount each year where we then have to pull money out of the general fund over into transportation to pay for our current contract, because as you've heard, we have the cost of living clause in there based on the Anchorage CPI. Section 3, hopefully I can give a little better idea to Senator Gardner on how we do it. Historically, what's happened on the Kenai is the tenured contracts we issue by March 16th. And then what happens is the non-tenured contracts have to be issued by May 15th, or you tell them they're non-retained. What's happened with both of those is a lot of times it depends on the financial situation and the financial outlook. The big part with non-tenured on May 15th is in the years that we had the forward funding with the 3 years forward funding, the BSA set increases and those things, we issued those contracts, the non-tenured contracts, we issued those in April in those years because we knew what our funding was and where we were at. In the years where we don't know where our funding is, we will wait until May 15th to see where we're going to be at, both with the state funding and our local funding. And then at that point in time, depending on where the funding is, we may have to issue pink slips, as folks say. The change to the date for May 15th from March 16th for us does two things specifically that I can think of as I'm sitting here. One is, in the years where we have concerns about the finances, you know, due to either declining enrollment or inflation or those things, right now, to riff a tenured teacher, we would have to do that by March 16th, and we don't really know where our funding is at that point in time. By moving it to May 15th, it gives us the ability to know, okay, are we really going to have to do reductions in force with tenured teachers? The other thing that it does, moving that date for us, is currently, if we have concerns with a tenured teacher, and we are going to put them on a plan for improvement, the schedule that we have to do that would require that we would put them on that plan for improvement about a month after school started. And that's, when you look at it, it's not really fair to the teacher or to the students in that classroom that we're going to jump on a plan for improvement that early in the year. You know, what the change does to May 15th for us then is moves that timeline back 2 months, gives us a better chance to work with the teacher and get some improvement before we have to actually go to a plan. So to wrap it up, the Kenai School District is in full support of all sections of this bill. Urge you to pass it forward. I want to thank you for your time this morning. And again, I want to thank you for your prior support of funding for education.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jones. Good to hear from you. Glad things are going so well for you there. And in Kenai, we miss you in Kodiak. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. We have two folks from Matsu, Dr. Deanna Paramo and also Catherine Gardner, and I believe they both want to testify. Dr. Paramo, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Dina Paramo, and I'm the superintendent of the Matsu Borough School District. I'd like to begin by thanking the legislature for focusing on the real costs associated with educating kids in Alaska. And within this bill are some of those items, as well as focusing on energy and technology and the Matsu Borough School District does support the three provisions within this bill. And as a school district, we are very strategic in literacy acquisition and parent The item that I'm going to focus on would be the transportation, and the next speaker will follow up in support of the notice of non-retention. Last session, Senate Bill 182 that's been referenced here addressed pupil transportation funding for the fiscal years 2013 to 2015. Please know that it only focused on 2 years to bring the school districts that use the majority of transportation and busing in line to have our contracts end at the same time so that the Department of Education can get involved in perhaps using the economy of scale to bid for a new contract, perhaps statewide. That was the idea behind just the 2 years. Nevertheless, the year-to-year increases established within this measure were based on a standardized increase of 1.5% for both fiscal years, 2014 and 2015. To our knowledge, there are no transportation contracts within the state of Alaska that are limited to only that 1.5% increase in their annual cost escalation language. In reality, the vast majority of contracts in the state refer to the annual percentage increase in the Anchorage Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers, or the CPIU, as determined by the United States Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics. The percentage difference between the amount of money Matsu Borough School District is slated to receive through Senate Bill 182 and the annual cost escalation depicted is actually 2 to 3% is the CPI. So it creates a potential funding shortfall in regard to our district's transportation services. This funding shortfall is, of course, the amount of instructional dollars available to be sent in the classroom. Using current language from SB 182, Matsu Borough School District prepared our budget to subsidize transportation services from its general fund by approximately $1.5 million. This transportation subsidy will impact Matsu Borough School District's ability to fund instructional programs and staff needed in our teaching positions. In fact, a $1.5 million shortfall is the equivalent of 15 teaching positions that would need to be reduced in the Matsu Borough School District's operating budget. While House Bill last year, 120, will not erase while Senate bill will not erase the transportation shortfall in its entirety, save us approximately $500,000 that we can put back into our classrooms. And we just see the benefit of utilizing transportation dollars for transportation and the operating budget and the general fund to support the classroom. With that being said, I'm just going to end my testimony, and I can answer any questions needed, and then I'll let you move on to our next speaker. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Paramo. I appreciate your comments on the impact it would have on your budget and the issue of it really equaling a 15-teacher position. So thank you. Any further questions, Dr. Paramo? Again, thank you very much. Let's move on to Catherine Gardner. Ms. Gardner?
Good morning. My name is Catherine Gardner. I'm the Human Resources Director for the Mount Sioux School District. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning, and my comments are going to be focused specifically to Section 3, which is the changing of the required date for non-retention from March 16th to May 15th. Now, before I begin some of the comments that I prepared, I want to give a little bit of clarification. There is a separate law that exists for teachers regarding employment, and if a teacher holds tenure in the state of Alaska, they have what's referred to as automatic reemployment. So when a district gives a contract is really not the most relevant consideration in looking at this change in date, because if the district fails to give notice of non-retention by now, March 16th, what you are looking to change to May 15th, they're automatically reemployed for the subsequent school year, regardless of whether we've taken the steps to issue them a contract to sign or not. That provision is still in place. So when school districts issue contracts, may not be what's most important in considering this date before you, because that date is a deadline for us regardless of when we hand out the pieces of paper or not. If we don't provide the notice by March 16th, they're automatically reemployed. So we have no ability to reduce a potential deficit through a non-retention or to take action on a teacher who's struggling as a result of that after that date. The current statutory requirement that exists provides some key problems for us if it being so early. First, rarely is the district's financial situation known by this early date. With state government still in session and our local financial contributions also unknown, the development of subsequent year's budget is very much built on projections, assumptions, and predictions. To make a final and binding determination on an expense which can make up between 80 and 90% of our total before revenue is known is really not good fiscal policy. On one hand, we risk employing a workforce which cannot be sustained if revenues are not provided under our best estimates. And on the other, we risk potentially disrupting and creating a difficult environment by issuing notices unnecessarily so early. Second, issuing a notice of non-retention or effectuating a reduction in force is a decision that could be detrimental to make unnecessarily. Unfortunately, if a district suspects or projects a need for this to happen, it's required to provide notice with at least 2 months left in the school year. Whether that notice is really the result of poor performance or the need for a RIF or to issue pink slips, as they've been referred to, this is a very early date and a delicate problem for school administrators. Our priority, of course, is to ensure a productive, healthy, and engaging learning environment for each student, and the potential for disruption and panic when we have to issue and discuss layoffs so early is a very real possibility. Finally, the administrative burden that exists in issuing notices is significant. There exists a number of requirements which districts must follow to comply with the current body of law. This is compounded greatly if these notices are issued prematurely and were not necessary, as at that time we transition into the return of teachers on a layoff status. In the end, both teachers and the district have suffered a process and turmoil which is contrary to providing that great education that we hope to do. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that we wouldn't be very glad to have the ability to return these teachers to the classroom, but the burden by having to issue the notices prematurely is what we're hoping to avoid by a change in the date back to May 15th rather than the early March 16th. We're very supportive of this section and hope that you give it great consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions as I understand this is a very technical aspect of the law.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Gardner. Things are never simple, are they? But I appreciate your explanation of how you have to deal with things. So any questions of Ms. Gardner on this issue? I think we understand what you've said. And so just tell me, how does it work if you do give a notice of non-retention and find later that you have the budget you didn't think you were going to have? Then what is the process you go through to reinstate a teacher? Is it simply just a notice of that the pink slip is canceled? How does that work?
No, it's quite complicated, actually. what comes into play also are the contracts that a specific district has. But typically what's going to happen is rather than being able to place individuals back into the positions for which they were holding successfully, we're going to have to look at seniority order. And so we will have people who might be at different buildings than they were originally hired. They might be at different grade levels. They might be in different programs. And so you create a massive shuffle that can be very disruptive. And you also put people into situations maybe that weren't planned for. They can sometimes be happy that they're employed, but usually the situation is not the way that it was the year previous. So it's not quite so simple as just revoking the non-retention. The method in which we bring them back is very structured, and we don't really have discretion as a district to determine necessarily the best teachers for the best positions. We're going to look at seniority and their endorsement as the primary driving factors, which is different than a traditional hiring process where we have a great deal more discretion to make sure we get the right people in the right positions.
Thank you, Ms. Gardner. For the comments or questions, I appreciate your explanation. Let's move on to Abby Hensley with Best Beginnings. Ms. Hensley, are you online?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the other members of the committee as well. My name is Abby Hensley. I'm the Executive Director of Best Beginnings, the statewide initiative that's devoted to ensuring all Alaska children begin school ready to succeed. In general, we focus on the birth to five age range, but we're also concerned about what happens to children when they enter kindergarten and beyond, especially in regard to learning to read. Parent engagement in their children's learning is critical, and we often hear the phrase, parents are a child's first teacher, and we strongly believe that. Therefore, I'm pleased to offer support for the section called Kindergarten through Grade 3, Parent Information in Senate Bill 57. The remaining sections are outside our scope. Providing information to parents and guardians about helping support their children's efforts in learning to be good readers is important. I think we can agree that all children should be proficient readers by the end of third grade, thereby being more likely to graduate from high school on time, go on to further training or education, and become contributing members of society. In the early childhood world, parent engagement and the development of early literacy skills go hand in hand. This is the case in away-from-home programs like Head Start and quality child care and preschool programs, as well as parents as teachers and infant learning home visiting programs. Imagination libraries, supported by Best Beginnings, hold parent engagement events, and parent engagement and education is one of the four pillars that all Best Beginnings early childhood partnerships work on in their communities. Continuing this effort into kindergarten and the early grades makes a lot of sense. We're learning that parents of young children are receiving information in a variety of ways these days, so we recommend a multifaceted communications campaign that provides information in a variety of ways, not just those we've relied on in the past. For example, recently I sat next to a young man on an airplane who was using his iPhone, while others were still boarding, I should add, to read and respond to Facebook posts. I asked him if he also used Facebook on a computer. He said no, just on his phone. So we need to think differently about how young parents access needed information, not just about the content. And we need to think about who parents trust to give them accurate and useful information. Engaging parents in supporting their young children's early literacy efforts is critical to their children's success. Thank you for including this in your deliberations.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Hensley, and of course for all the efforts you have put into Best Beginnings over the years. Could you tell us, from your knowledge of statewide, how this has been handled? Do you probably see a difference, I assume, in how districts deal with this whole issue of assisting parents and early reading? Do you have any comments on how things are differ throughout the state?
Senator Stevens, thank you for the question. Because we deal, you know, pretty much all together with children before they reach kindergarten, we don't have a lot of of information about how specific districts might go about informing parents of kindergartners and beyond about early reading and what they need to do. I know that in Anchorage, right now we're involved with United Way of Anchorage and some other partners, along with the Anchorage School District, in figuring out kind of that bridge between between early childhood and kindergarten. And so I know that that district, at the very least, is reaching out to the early childhood community to figure out how to make that a good transition. In terms of providing information to parents, I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Hensley. I appreciate all your efforts. Any questions or comments, thoughts? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, any further discussion, anybody else have any comments they'd care to make from the audience at this time on Senate Bill 57? Intention is to hold this over for further consideration in due course, and we'll have a public hearing at that time. Further comments? We'll have an opportunity to hear from folks later then. So we'll set this bill aside and return to it very soon. Let's move on to Senate Bill 47, and we have Senator Coghill's aide, Reneva, with us. Thank you for being here, Reneva. Do you care to present the bill? We'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, my name is Reneva Moss. I'm staff for Senator Coghill, and I wish to apologize for Senator Coghill. He's in a finance subcommittee meeting, so can't present the bill. And I want to thank Senator Stevens, Senator Huggins, and Senator Gardner for past support of boarding schools. This has been a progression that started back in 2005 when Senator Coghill introduced House Bill 16, and it started the discussion of boarding homes. At that time, there was an existing program within the Department of Education that allowed them to pay stipends for students who were coming from communities that didn't have 9 through 12 education.
Excuse me, Ray, if I could, are you going to be discussing the version P that's in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Actually, then maybe if I could have a motion to take up version P for discussion purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I move version 28LS0408P.
Thank you. Is there any objection to that? Then we have version P in front of us, and thank you, Ms. Moss.
And back in 2005, the Department of Education was providing a stipend that was about $500 a month per student. And when House Bill 16 was passed, we did use the same regional rates that the Department of Education had been using, and stipends were set for any high school student who wished to attend a residential boarding school at $500 a month. There's been a steady increase in the program through the years, and it has helped rural students attend residential boarding schools that offer more classes, more vocational training, and it allows them to participate in sports, band, and art that they otherwise wouldn't be able to attend in communities that either didn't have high schools or only had a couple of students. We believe, Senator Coghill and myself believe, that these boarding schools have provided an excellent curriculum for students who want to go on to college, and definitely that curriculum would not have been available in the village schools, and they are more prepared for college. In fact, a higher percentage of the students go to college when they come from boarding schools. A higher percentage of the students are focused on what they want to do when they get out of high school, either going on to college, going to vocational school. Many of them join the armed forces. But most of them, with few exceptions, go on to succeed in the private sector and in workforce. Many of these students would be dropout statistics if they didn't have the option of going to a boarding school. And we feel that's real important with the high rate of dropout we already have in the public school system. Anything that we can do to prevent that dropout, we want to encourage. You're going to be hearing testimony from people who are directly involved with the boarding school system, and you're going to hear that these students succeed. overwhelmingly. The stipend helps the schools cover the cost of residential boarding school facilities, which includes 3 square meals a day and 24/7 supervision. When these schools start a boarding school, they also create a liability that they take very seriously, that they are in custody of those children, that they protect those children, and they take care of them. In 2011, the program was expanded with increased stipends. The legislature actually doubled the rates, and that helped the school districts cover the costs better, but they're still spending more money than what they're receiving to take care of boarding school students. So today I present to you Senate Bill 47, Version P, and I just want to explain about a half a dozen things that this bill does. The first thing it does is, under existing law, boarding schools have to have been in operation before June 1st, 2005, and we have deleted that requirement, so it opens it up for more boarding schools to be created within the public school system in Alaska. It also,
can you tell us while you're there, Ms. Moss, have there been schools open since 2005?
Mr. Chairman, actually, there's a provision on the books that would allow the Department of Education to expand it to 3 additional boarding schools. They are out advertising solicitation for 3 additional schools at this time, and I'm sure they will discuss that process with you when they testify. Okay. This section actually adds some terminology called variable length school terms, which allows for magnet schools.
And would you say that again? What is it called?
It's called variable length. In other words, it could be less than 180 days, but the total classroom participation would have to be, for that school, would have to be 180 days for them to qualify for a boarding school. This allows for magnet schools, and you will be hearing some testimony about some school districts that would like to participate in that process, and school districts that will create training, vocational training, that creates good-paying jobs for people in rural Alaska. Section 2 addresses the regional base rates for stipends, and this section triples what the base rate was in 2005. Section 3 allows public school districts to contract with private Alaska Native organizations or nonprofit organizations to provide room and board services. Section 4 is a repealer. It repeals the limit of 3 additional boarding schools, and it repeals the definition of district-operated statewide residential programs, because we now, in Section 1, have included that terminology for both statewide and district-wide residential schools, so the definition is no longer required. And then Section 5 provides for an immediate effective date. We are asking you to make a policy call. We believe that these boarding schools will continue to offer high school students in small communities an opportunity to attend high school, an opportunity to have classes that better prepare them for college, better prepare them for vocational training as in F-Tech, and prepare them for getting a job in the workplace in Alaska. We believe that by removing the limit on the number of boarding schools, that new opportunities are going to arise for Alaskan high school students to get training that will qualify them for meaningful jobs. There is one school in the Kotzebue area that's looking at a magnet school that would be working in cooperation with Red Dog Mine to train kids from the area to actually get a good-paying job at Red Dog. Senator Coghill has always said that boarding schools aren't the only avenue of success for education, but they are definitely one very important avenue of success, and we ask for your support.
Thank you, Mrs. Moss. Appreciate your comments. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I'm actually really excited to see this come forward, and I remember talking about it years ago with then-Commissioner Ledoux and with Reggie Jewell. And what Representative Jewell said about it was he didn't want to see it come from the legislature. He said it needed to ferment down below and then come to us in that way so that it's not something imposed, even though it's an opt-in. Mm-hmm. Has that been part of the process? I mean, did...
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, yes, it has. In fact, we have had several Native organizations and several rural school districts come to us and ask us to introduce this legislation because they have plans to provide training in rural Alaska, and this is the mechanism that they need to do it.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner.
I'm one of the few legislators who went to a boarding school, although I went 3 years to a boarding school myself.
I think it was in London, though, wasn't it?
Hertfordshire.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yes, that's true. But I guess my question is, do you know what the rationale was for limiting the applicability of boarding school laws to three schools? Was it just to take in the additional and not allow more?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I really don't know what the Department of Education's rationale was. I know when this first started, there was a lot of concern about displacing students in rural Alaska and risking closing schools down. So there was a feeling that this might be competition for the public school system. However, this is operated through the public school system.
Thank you. And I have one.
Yes, please, Senator Gardner.
You talked about how Section 2 triples the base rate from 2005. Have costs risen that much? Were we dramatically underfunding before 2005, or are we offering expanded services?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, when we first presented this legislation, it was our hope that parents and school districts could absorb some of the costs. But that has not been the case. And yes, costs have gone up. Fuel costs have hit everybody statewide. It's a tremendous burden in rural Alaska. So I am going to be passing out some information. I didn't want to overwhelm you with information today, so I have brought some information for Tim to distribute that will show you what the actual costs are for room and board. For the four boarding schools that are in operation now, that is Bethel, Nenana, Galena, and Mount Edgecombe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Moss. Could you help us understand magnet schools? Could you explain that a little bit better and just give us a definition of what we mean when we talk about magnet schools?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert at it, but magnet schools
are
schools that provide vocational training and educational courses. They're shorter term, and there are different terms, and that's why we put the language in the way it was. There may be some that are 30 days, there may be some that are 3 months, there may be some that are 6 months. It just depends on the type of training and the credentials that a student would get at the end of that training. But it does require them to have educational curriculum along with the vocational training.
Thank you. Further questions, discussions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reneva, I think there's another complicating factor with boarding schools, and that's how you fund the housing. Could you just give us a quick burst on that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but the boarding schools actually have their own facilities right now. Mount Edgecombe, of course, is state-owned. They contract for room and board. But the other schools actually have their own boarding school facilities. So they hire supervision for the facility. They prepare the meals, and they provide the housing.
Yeah, I guess that my if I might, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman,
please, Mr. Huggins.
As I recall, though, that according to the area, you can be, for the debt reimbursement, 70-30, whatever the ratio turns out to be. You can do that for the school, but not the boarding area. But could you help us out with that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. Yes, that is an issue, and I'll probably ask the Department of Education to address that, because the 70-30 reimbursement program cannot be used for boarding facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mrs. Moss, you mentioned Red Dog. They were in my office a few weeks ago, as apparently to all of our offices, and talking about they have an agreement with a Native corporation there to hire 100% of the, I think, the members of that corporation to work at Red Dog, but they've never been able to achieve that because they've never had enough graduates. So this would, in essence, help people find jobs, help the Red Dog operation comply with their contract.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to put words in their mouths, but we're real excited.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. For the comments? Thank you very much, Mrs. Moss. I see the commissioner has arrived. Sir, we don't want to impose upon you, but if you have any comments to make, we'd certainly appreciate your thoughts. Commissioner Hanley.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. For the record, my name is Mike Hanley. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Education, and the House is hearing the companion bill, and that's where I was earlier this morning. I could probably just give you a little bit of the background into where the Department of Education is. We have recognized the value of the changes in this bill. When it comes to three, why there were three in there, when I look back at legislative history, it seemed to be, and it's not particularly clear, it wasn't driven by the Department of Education. It seemed to be a way to manage growth, that there might have been concern about too many coming online at the same time, and by limiting it to three, that would put some parameters on that. What we have done recently is we recognize what's currently in statute is that the statute speaks to schools that operate for a full school year. We don't believe that that prohibited variable term programs as long as the schools operated as a school for the full school year, for that 180 days. I'm sure that that was already addressed. We have just recently, the state board has recently, as of last week, adopted a regulation that allows for the variable term component with some funding mechanisms in there that allows the boarding stipend to go to those schools. The BSA would stay with the student's home district. So we have already seen that need. The other opportunity that the department has is to open up periods of public application, or open application is what the statute says, and we have recently done that as well because we've seen a desire for it and a need for it. So that corresponding with the variable term component, that open application period is currently open and will be open until the end of this month.
Yes, Senator Gardner, please.
Thank you. When you talk about open application, you're talking about new schools potentially as opposed to open enrollment?
Yeah, through the chair, that's correct. This is open application for new schools.
Thank you.
For comments or questions, Senator Huggins?
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Commissioner. The age, or correction, the grade span for the schools, is there any limit or target?
Through the chair, statutory is 9 through 12.
9 through 12. So on the other hand, all right, we hear advocates saying Head Start is the most important thing we could do for education today. Why wouldn't we do Head Start? Or why wouldn't we do K-6? I mean, if you get my point, if you don't start early enough in education process.
Through the chair, I believe this is just focused on that boarding component, mm-hmm. And I think I have a hard time speaking for others, but I think there's been a hesitancy to look to boarding young students, younger than high school students, kind of the moral issue that gets involved in that conversation. So I think that's largely where it is and just limited to high school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your comments. I know you've been busy today running from hearing to hearing. What's the opposition to this? What are you hearing? What's the concern about it? It seems to be a good idea on the surface. What are you hearing as those who may be opposed to it?
Chair Stevens, I have not heard any opposition to this. Obviously, the primary component of this begins with the boarding stipend increase. And I would recognize that if that sunsets this year and goes back, the programs we currently have in place, the three that are funded through this, will really struggle. to meet their responsibilities to board students. So that is a primary component. But I've only heard positives. I've heard people, well, could we try this? It's really opened the door for ideas of better ways to meet the needs of students. We see programs currently in place that offer these variable terms, and you've heard the Kotzebue is looking at one, and the RANSET model that does great things out of Bethel. They're excited about this opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Gardner.
After the application period closes, do you anticipate it would be reopened on a regular basis once things sort of start running? Get off the ground.
Through the chair, I'm not aware of one ever being open prior to me opening this current one. But yes, it's based on perceived need and capacity and interest. That's what's in the language now. So I surely have that ability to do so. I would definitely anticipate, if this were to go through, that our current one ends the end of this month, and yet this will change some of the components of it, and that I would anticipate opening another one relatively soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a couple people who would like to testify. Gary Baldwin from Bethel. Mr. Baldwin, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I can hear everybody but Senator Gardner. I don't know if it's her microphone, but
we've readjusted that, so you should be able to hear her now.
Sorry.
Thank you. And for the record, would you identify yourself, Mr. Baldwin?
Yes, this is Gary Baldwin. I am superintendent of Lower Kuskokwim Schools, which is Bethel and 22 surrounding villages. And I'm speaking today in support of SB 47. And the reason I am is because we have two outstanding programs that will struggle mightily without it. The first one I want to speak to briefly is Kuskokwim Learning Academy, which was formerly Bethel Alternative Boarding School. And it is a school with about 60 students that targets dropouts, and the goal is to have them graduate or as a fallback, last resort, prepare them for the GED, but our goal is really to get them to be graduates. And it's been successful for a number of years and certainly depends heavily on that stipend amount. It's one that has been approved by the state. The other program that I want to talk about is our RANSET program, and it is one that really needs the flexibility in language for variable term, district operated, and then to be able to contract with a nonprofit for the boarding home component. RANSEP is currently supplemented by funding from the Rasmussen Foundation, and so that funding will erode. It is tapering down next year. We're in pretty good shape to run it next year, but after that we will have a real hard time running the boarding component of that without the passage of this bill. The RANSET program provides ANSEP access to our village students, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program, and they have recently identified Bethel as an academy school, Bethel High School, and so that our village students would also have access to that, we developed this program called RANSET because of the Rasmussen funding. And the gist of it is that students come in from villages for a semester at a time to take upper-level math, physics, chemistry, and pre-engineering courses along with their regular other courses. And what we have found is that these students, there's something that we call cohort power, where they work together, learn together, struggle together, and then support each other. And the success rate has been very high. What we have found is that these students, we give them the AccuPlacer test, which is a placement test that colleges use. And these students will test into entry-level credit-bearing courses at the college, whereas similar peers who don't go through this experience often, as you probably know, have to take developmental coursework before they can enter credit-bearing courses when they attend college. And so through this program, students, we sort of call it you can have your cake and eat it too, in that students don't lose identity with their home village and their home school because they come in only for semesters during their junior and senior year. And so they maintain connection with their home school and with their families. They graduate from their home school, and it just seems to work out well because they're well grounded in their culture and language, as well as having a course of academic rigor. What we do, we have a very extensive robotics program, junior high, senior high robotics program, and we have found that this is a great way to get kids motivated toward engineering careers and math and science. And so that's sort of our feeder program. And we found that these kids, when they go back from in the semester at home, at their home school, they talk to their friends and they talk about what a cool program it is. And, oh, by the way, if you're not taking Algebra 1 as a ninth grader, you probably should be so that you can get into this program. And so what we found is that it's sort of raising the bar in our village schools in terms of kids' own expectations for themselves in academic rigor. And so we've also noticed that a lot of these kids, we're hearing a lot more of our students talk about post-secondary training and careers in the future and future goals in that regard, and so it's very gratifying. What we're hoping to do is use this same model not just for engineering careers, but aviation is a big thing out here. Bethel has the third busiest runway in Alaska. We're hoping to get an academic or aviation academy going along those using the same model. So I'll be happy to answer questions, but that's a brief rundown on why we need this bill to be passed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Baldwin. I appreciate hearing from you and learning what's going on out there. Would you say then, without a boarding school, that there'd be substantially more more kids dropping out of their educational plans?
Yes, I believe both of these programs have been successful at preventing dropouts and recovering dropouts. Certainly the Kuskokwim Learning Academy, they recruit dropouts very heavily, contact them, call them, and get them back into school and get them graduated.
And just to remind us, Mr. Baldwin, what age of young folks can you be dealing with and trying to get them through the academy?
Kuskokwim Learning Academy deals with students 9 through 12, and recovering dropouts, often they end up with older students into their up to 20. And then the RANSET program is more specific to juniors and seniors in high school.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Baldwin, for clarifying that. Further questions? Well, appreciate your comments, Mr. Baldwin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll go on then to Lisa Rieger in Anchorage. She's with Kokanut Tribal Council. Ms. Rieger. Is Lisa Rieger with us?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry, I'm monitoring both hearings at the same time. So I have a few minutes of comments, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, please identify yourself for the record, if you would.
I will do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak today about the need for changes to the state law regarding residential sites. My name is Lisa Rieger, and I have the privilege to serve as General Counsel of Cook Inlet Tribal Council. Gloria O'Neill, our President and CEO, sends her regards and regrets that she cannot present this information herself today. As you have been hearing, the statute currently authorizing a residential education program currently is written in a too specific a way to support the creative solutions that are developing around the state. And like the delegates of the Alaska Federation of Natives, CIPC supports the changes to Senate Bill 47 to provide a more flexible and open framework for the residential components of education in Alaska. Because the stipend has currently been woefully insufficient for those programs that are operating, we support the increase in the stipend. We also support the school districts delivering district-wide residential programs and the variable length program. And in particular, of course, we support the local partnership provision between school districts and Alaska Native or nonprofit organizations to provide the residential experience for the students. During AFN this past year, AFN delegates and representatives from state agencies and legislature engaged in a lengthy work session about these issues. They've identified the good work that's happening around the state and the desire to expand regional opportunities in the Northwest Borough, Barrow, and Tope, as well as our own efforts in Anchorage, which has led to the support for the changes in the residential stipend before you today. There's a general consensus that from those meetings that more partnership with Alaska Native organizations and more incorporation of culturally relevant curriculum will lead to greater success both for Alaska's rural students as well as its urban students. To tell you a little bit about our program, CITC has launched the Denina Academy, which is a public-private partnership model that might be replicated throughout the state. It's a partnership between CITC and the Anchorage School District. In that partnership, we provide the room, board, and residential program, while the Anchorage School District continues to provide academic and other extracurricular programs to students. And just by way of an aside, CITC and the Anchorage School District have over a decade of partnering, where we have been providing school-within-school teachers in those small Alaska Native classrooms to great success. And I can speak to some of that success in the question and answer period after my comments. I'm trying to keep to the minimum here. Our Denina Academy residential program is designed as a culture-based leadership program to provide room and board, social and academic supports for the students. They live, study, and play in a cohort. They have live-in advisors, elders, and tutors who ensure an environment that promotes and supports holistic student development, including positive identity, academic competence, confidence, cultural and community connection, expectations for community service, and Alaska Native cultural activities, sport, and music. It's different from previous attempts at boarding programs because of its focus on Alaska Native culture and its ownership by an Alaska Native organization. So we support the changes in the statute contained in Senate Bill 47 that will allow existing programs to expand, will support the establishment of more programs offering creative solutions to Alaska's educational challenges, and including those that have already proved so successful. It also enables communities to offer more opportunities to students, and especially in closing the achievement gap. The flexibility that Senate Bill 47 provides will result in new choices for Alaska students. Thank you for your leadership and attention, and I have a lot more information, but I wanted to keep to the time frame. So.
Well, thank you, Ms. Riga. We appreciate your brevity, but also I think we also appreciate hearing a little bit more about the Denina Academy. Can you tell us where is it located, what's it like, what's your involvement, what's the Kukana Tribal Council's involvement? I'm not sure I really understand. Are the students in Anchorage? Are they brought in from the villages? Just help us understand the academy a little bit more, if you would.
Okay. I'm happy to do so. Well, as I mentioned, we just started. We're in a pilot stage of our program. And we are one of the programs that will be applying, that is applying currently with the Anchorage School District in the open period that the commissioner referenced in his testimony. And in our program, we have, currently, we just have two students to pilot the program and to test it out. Both of those students come from two different kinds of situations, and I think they represent some of the types of targets of our students. So we're not going to be a program for some severely emotionally disturbed students or those who are wrestling with, issues that would require professional assistance. So it's not a therapeutic environment. It's designed to be an academic supportive environment. And so one of our students, for example, had been living in Anchorage with his family. His family moved back to Dillingham, and he wanted to finish high school in Anchorage. So he's one of the types of students that we might encounter. On the other side of the equation, we have a student whose family was experiencing intense and continues to intense homelessness here within Anchorage, and so really needed a stable home situation in order to continue his studies. And so that's another component of the population that we would be addressing. Just for your information, 43% of the students who come into Anchorage from rural Alaska in the last 2 years came without their parents. And so there's a lot of disruption in home environments as students come in from the village for opportunities in Anchorage, and then it doesn't pan out. So that's another source of the population. Would we be open to a student calling us from a village and saying we'd like to come in and be part of the Nine Academy? Absolutely. There's a wide range of students who we might target. In terms of the program itself, as I said, we're in the starting phase. We have house parents and we have house parents now. We'll be having elders who also reside with the students, and they will be providing all of the support around services, as well as the students obviously have access to CITC's youth opportunities programs that we have on our main campus, as well as access to our academic counselors and our academic programs in West and Bartlett High Schools. Have I answered your question?
Well, I think so. I'm just trying to understand that. You are providing is a room and board facility, and the students are then enrolled in public schools in Anchorage. Is that my understanding at this point?
That's correct, and that's the intent.
And that is the intent of the future. You would try to expand that, I assume, but it would still remain the same. It would be a room and board facility, and students would be enrolled in the regular education program?
That's correct. That's why it's a partnership between us and the Anchorage School District.
Right,
so
right.
We would be providing the residential.
Well, thank you. What students would be invited eventually? Would it be students from throughout Alaska, or just the students who are enrolled in the Kukanut Tribal Council membership? How does that work?
It's not limited at all to in any way. It would be open to students from around the state, referrals from within Anchorage. It's important to recognize that Anchorage and several other places in the state have a really different situation. And one of the things that I just wanted to mention is that we've been running this in-school program in the Anchorage School District for over 10 years, and although we do achieve great success in terms of high school graduation and improving scores, one of the things that is universally identified is the disruptive living situation that really prevents our students from reaching their success. And so, for example, if a student is in our program at Bartlett, but their parents or their family has to move to Ocean View, that's now a 45-minute drive without access to school transportation to get back to our program. And so even though they're all within the same district, it's a huge transportation barrier and a huge barrier for our students, and they end up having to switch schools. So one of our goals with this program is to keep kids in the same school for the whole period of time. And our school, right now, we're geared towards juniors and seniors, and particularly to boys who have, as you probably are aware, half the graduation rate as a girl and twice the dropout rate. So we're really working at that population, but we also will be expanding it to girls as well.
Well, thank you, Ms. Rieger. I appreciate what you're doing and the impact you're having. Shocking to hear that almost half the students that come to Anchorage are without their parents. That's got to add to your difficulties. But thank you very much. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Yes, I'm thinking of at least three categories of kids who might want to consider your program, and those are kids who are at SAVE, who had dropped out of high school or are trying to get back. Many of them are trying to support themselves and go to school part-time and find that very much a challenge. Another is some of the kids at Covenant House who simply don't have homes to live in, and many of them don't fit your profile because they might require counseling and other kinds of services, but some of them might be very open to finding safe housing and being able to continue schooling. And the other group I'm thinking of is those who are sort of on the point of aging out of foster care. And several years ago, we passed legislation to continue supporting those students who were still going to school. But it seems like a supportive living environment such as yours might fit their needs better than what other living opportunities they're trying to use. Have you thought about any of those categories of students?
Well, all of them. Thank you very much. I guess all of them, with the exception of, I'm not sure if our boots on the ground have started relationships with SAVE yet, but certainly, you know, we distinguish ourselves from Covenant House because we're not a short-term emergency shelter. So there may very well come referrals from Covenant House. They're really aware of our program. We've worked closely with Deirdre Cronin when she was the executive director and now with Allison Kerr to make sure that we have that communication and relationship. And then in terms of the youth aging out of foster care, we actually have been working with Facing Foster Care in Alaska, Amanda Metzubier, who's doing a bridge program into the university right now, and looking at what population, you know, whether she's identified students who might be needing to finish high school in order to get to the university. So we are already working those angles right now. You know, we're taking referrals from whomever might, you know, have an appropriate student, and we're vetting them through our process and making sure that they are willing to subject themselves to the discipline and the structure that's going to be part of this household, as well as that we're able to manage whatever issues that they might have, that they might bring to the mix.
Thank you. You're ahead of me.
No, those are great ideas.
Thank you so much. Further discussion? Well, thank you, Ms. Rieger, for appearing, and please extend our thanks to the Covenant Tribal Council for their efforts and to the Academy. We're glad to hear what you're doing, and appreciate your comments. Any further comments?
We really appreciate you very much. So thank you very much for putting this bill forward.
Thank you, Lisa. Further comments anybody has at this time that we've not heard from? My intention is to set this aside. We'll be dealing with it as soon as we can. But Mrs. Moss, any concluding comments? Are you happy with where we are?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted to respond to a question that Senator Huggins had about elementary school. In working on this legislation, we have found there is some interest in figuring out a way to take care of elementary school students. And we have committed with Representative Gaddis to look at some legislation that will deal with that situation. So we're not ignoring it. We want to deal with it, but we at the same time know it's going to take a longer process than what this is. So we want to do it with two different vehicles.
Thank you, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Reneva. And you know, that in my mind is so important because, as Senator Gardner was talking about, the Covenant House and other places, we can identify those students early on so they aren't in Covenant House potentially. So it's an interdiction mechanism. Mr. Chairman, if I might, one question for Reneva. I noticed the funding here, you named some sites. I don't see Camp Challenge on here, which is a boarding school.
If we're ready. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm not familiar with them, but I do know that there's only three schools currently that receive stipends, and that is Bethel, Lower Kuskokwim, Galena, and Nenana.
Right. So in this case, Camp Challenge is a statewide program. And it's a boarding school. It looks like they would fit the definition. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we might want to check that just to see what the case might be. I know it's not 9 through 12, but it's still the same sort of target population.
Sure. Appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you for the comments. Well, we will set this bill aside and deal with it imminently, and we're adjourned.